With the brief review of what we studied last week, and that way it will give more time even for those who are still coming in. Thank everyone for coming, and of course, thank the Margulies for hosting. I will do my best to stand as long as possible, especially given the layout. I know it'll be difficult otherwise for people to see me, but hopefully we'll make it. Last week, as we began our study, we focused on the fact, again, without getting into all of the details, we focused on the fact that the Rambam created somewhat of a revolution. How much of the revolution will be the first topic we address tonight, but somewhat of a revolution as he formulated in his commentary on the Mishnah, in his introduction before the 10th parak of Masechet Sanhedrin. Can you hear me back there, Aaron? Okay, you wave red flag if you can't hear me. He formulated the 13 principles of faith, which he defined as being so significant that without which a person was not fully nichnas letoch klal Yisrael, they were not fully embraced and part of the Jewish community, and really beyond the status in this world, more perilous was and more ominous was the bleak future that a person of such unimpressive beliefs, the Rambam would have it in the next world. Really very, very strong language. Aside from the fact that he uses that language in introducing it, we also pointed out the historical impact and popularity of the Rambam's 13 principles, as evidenced by the fact that the two more well-known summaries, if you will, of the Rambam's principles, which in fact, although some at one time thought that they were, neither of which were written by the Rambam. One was about 200 years, the other was about 400 years after he died. One is the 13 Animamins, which were not written by him, as well as, of course, the song Yigdal, both of which have been popularized in our Siddur. Equipped last week, the Yigdal was written first, so maybe that's why it's at the beginning of davening in our Siddur. And then the 13 Animamins was written later, anonymously, and that's why we don't know who wrote the 13 Animamins, and that was why it's at the end of our davening. But be that as it may, they're both in our Siddurim. And that certainly gives it, if not a sophisticated philosophical stamp of approval, but certainly in terms of representative of how popular the Jewish people have made these, certainly it's indicative. How all-embracingly and authoritative those should be is really next week's topic. Again, 3 weeks is certainly not enough time to do justice, and certainly we won't even be studying them per se. As I had in the blurb on the flyer, this is really a overall meta-analysis of their place, their significance, and really even their controversy. A little bit of the controversy we'll see next week, and more of the contemporary controversy this week, and more of the contemporary controversy we can see next week. But we saw how significant the Rambam thought they were, how significant they became. We noted there's a debate. On the one hand, you have people like the Chafetz Chaim who said you should say the Animamins every single day. And to take another extreme, you had some, including Rav Soloveitchik, who felt that Yudavka should not say Yigdal at the end of davening, that was too much similar and really inspired by the catechism that Catholics end their service with. So, but that was, the so to speak, an interesting side technical debate. Neither the Chofetz Chaim or Rav Soloveitchik were denying the significance or centrality of the Rambam's 13 principles. And finally, what we ended last week with, which was really remarkable, I thought, was again, not so much how others per se saw it, although we did see the debate, but my focus was on to give you a sense of how significant the Rambam felt these principles were, and that is based on his comments in Hilchos Tshuva, where we see that, according to the Rambam, even accidental mistaken beliefs are heretical. Even if someone, through reading sources of Torah or Midrashim, but is misled, accidentally misreads something, and comes to a different belief than he has sketched out in the 13 principles, the Rambam considers that person, even so, heretical, despite the fact that, in general, in halacha and in Jewish tradition, we distinguish between the intentional or rebellious transgressor and the accidental, the shogeg. The Rambam does not seem to have any mitigating factor, and this was very controversial even in his general day, if you will. On the spot, none other than his famous interlocutor, the Ravid, says in a remarkable statement, Rabim Vitovim. The specific context was whether God has some sort of physical form. Does God have any corporeality? And the Rambam says very strongly, God is incorporeal. There's no physical essence to God. And the Ravid says, but what do you mean? Ram Vitovim. There were many who were even greater than the Rambam. An unbelievable statement, considering what he's about to say. They believed that God had some physical form. Not because they were heretical, per se, but because, if you look at the simple reading of the biblical text, it speaks about God's mighty arm. Midrashim used such language all the time, and they were misled. So we made it clear, I hope, that the Ravid didn't necessarily subscribe to that. He, I'm sure, agreed also that it was meant to be anthropomorphic and not meant to be taken literally. But he said, if somebody who's sincere and misled by misreading of the sources, how can you call them a heretic? We saw a number of others, like the Radvaz and Rav Yosef Albo, who agreed with the Ravid. But certainly in more recent days, and again, perhaps it coincides with the fact that the Rambam himself and these 13 principles have become so overridingly popular, many have taken his stringency even on this part, and we mentioned that, and we saw a number of different sources all quoting the famous Yiddish idiom of Reb Chaim Brisker, who in reflecting this idea said, Nebuch an Apikaris is Eichet an Apikaris. True, it's not his fault. He said, Nebuch, it's too bad, it's tragic. But he's still an apikaris. And we saw that quoted in a number of sources. Again, there were Rishonim who disagreed with this, not only the Ravid, and we even saw the last source of the evening, a letter from Rav Kook, where even though he's not explicitly addressing these 13 principles or this particular debate, it seems clear that he thinks that someone becomes a, quote, kofer or a heretic only if they do it b'mezid. So that is our summary from last week. I want to begin this week's study, so to speak, going backwards and then going forwards. If you'll turn to your source booklet, on the first page I want to share with you a relatively recent debate. It goes back all the way to 1999. And considering the time frame that we've been using, this is journalism, not history. About how radical a departure is the Rambam's list. In other words, we mentioned last week that if you look through all of the Gemaras, you will not find anything even close to the Rambam's list. He originated, he pioneered such a concept. There was one possible exception, so to speak, to the list, where you see Chazal explicitly speaking theologically, and that was the famous Mishnah, which begins the 10th Perek of Sanhedrin. Again, it's not coincidental that it was in his introduction to that Mishnah that the Rambam wrote his list. And it was there where the Mishnah says, starting off much more nicely, Kol Yisrael Yesh Lahem Chelek Olam Haba, all Jews, at least in theory, are promised at least some portion of the world to come, right? Whether you have a small one-room bedroom apartment, or you're in a palatial estate, you're in the front row or the back row, that'll depend on how you live your life, but everyone at least gets a ticket in. But then the Mishnah cautions that there are exceptions. Elu She'ein Lahem Chelek Olam Haba, then proceeds to list three things which have to do with belief, and another three, more or less, there's different opinions, Rabbi Akiva and Abba Shaul, adding another three, so even if you wanted to take the whole Mishnah as one, that would be six. But even the other three are really more behavioristic and not so much belief. The three beliefs that the Mishnah says one would lose their Olam Haba for, one was a rejection of Tchias HaMesim, the idea that in some form, someday, the dead will come back to life. If you reject that belief, it's heretical, says the Mishnah. Number two is if you reject the idea of Torah min hashamayim, the idea of the Torah being heavenly and not, God forbid, man-made, man-written, man-document. And the third, even there's only three, and even the third is not so clear. The third, the Mishnah uses as a very specific idea, but we're not exactly sure. There's a debate about what it means. But there the Mishnah uses the very infamous phrase, apikoros. Again, we use that colloquially, sometimes way too colloquially, in my opinion, although that'll be part of next week's class, to mean generally heresy. But it's clear the Mishnah, even if it meant something general, it didn't mean everything, because obviously it meant it's the third thing listed. So it doesn't include the first two. The first two are bad, but the first two are something else, apparently. So what exactly apikaris means in the Mishnah's view is not our question tonight, but those are the three things which clearly have to do with belief. And yet, we saw last week, and we noted this in the name of Professor Menachem Kellner, who's a contemporary professor of Jewish thought at Haifa University. We point out in his name, but you still, even those, not only are they a shorter list than the Rambam, it's still very much not the same. You don't have, right? It's in the negative. You are a heretic if you believe. There's still no systematic Jewish theology of you must believe X, Y, and Z to be a good Jew. So what is the consequence of that? How far do we want to take that? Which is another way of saying, as I said, how radical a departure is what the Rambam did. So if you turn to the top of the sheet, I was just mentioning to someone before I began that Dr. Kellner, not that this is a per se an endorsement of his specific conclusions, but in terms of a scholar who has spent perhaps the most time or effort in this area, it really is him. There are three books, at least two of which will be quoted at some point, maybe all three, I think, make it into tonight's lecture. He has three books that generally revolve around the topic from the medieval period of theology and principles of belief. There are many, many other articles. I've collected all sorts of books and articles to prepare the lecture, but he is the most prolific writer. And one of his books, which was actually the second, the third, I think this is the most recent one that he published, the one only 4 years ago, he has a book about dogma, which is much more scholarly and academic, and then people asked him to make it a little bit more popular. There's still plenty of footnotes, and it's plenty scholarly, but even the typeset's a little bit bigger, right? He used like a 10 font instead of an 8 font. They're both published by the Lippmann Library out of London. And this is the book that he calls Must a Jew Believe Anything? So he makes the following point after summarizing, this is from page 29 and 30, towards the beginning of his book, after pointing out all the uniquenesses of the Rambam's list and the fact that whatever you want to say about the Mishnah and Sanhedrin, it is not the same as that list, he comes to the following conclusion, which is that he seems that the Rambam made a very radical departure. But he speaks so strongly that he kind of catches himself. And he says, and I'm beginning the source inside, he doesn't mean to say, it's not exactly the case, that classical Judaism adopted an anything-goes attitude towards matters of belief. But rather, the rabbis functioned in a context with which there was, who and was not a Jew, was relatively clear. And in which there was a broad consensus concerning matters of religious belief, and very little attempt to pin down and codify the details of what is religious belief. People who violated the theological consensus were probably considered up to a point simply as strange. After some point, having placed themselves outside the community, the attitude of the rabbi towards matters of theology would seem was more laissez-faire than totally uninterested. But even that's obviously pretty strong, a statement. And then he says on the right side, the Mishnah and Sanhedrin, therefore, ought not to be seen as an attempt to lay down a self-conscious system of dogma for Judaism or set up a theological test for admission to the world to come. So it's something, but he thinks it's really radically different than the Rambam, or again, in another direction, that the Rambam is making a radical departure from the tradition of Chazal, from the tradition of the rabbis of the Talmudic period. Or even the Mishnaic period, I should say. There's been much, you can imagine, you know, some academic books are read by two people. And other books, because of their topic or their author, gain much more, at least readership, if not followers. And this topic, needless to say, is certainly one that attracts much attention. And one of the critical reviews that was written of this book was written by Professor David Berger, who may be still somewhat familiar. I believe he was once a guest in Shomrei. He lives in Queens. He's a father of one of my good friends. And he is a jack of all trades. His particularly scholarly expertise is in medieval Jewish-Christian relations. He is, I think, considered the single biggest expert in the world in his field. He teaches more full-time at SUNY University in New York, and he's also, I think, still considered part-time, but he's every single year very, very regularly up at Yeshiva University as well. Very involved in a number of issues, very involved in the RCA. He has a smicha from YU as well. And Dr. Berger, whose real issue is history per se, but needless to say, as I mentioned, his area of history very much overlaps both chronologically and topically with this topic. And he wrote the review in the journal Tradition, which is an intellectual journal published by the RCA, the Rabbinical Council, later that year in 1999. And he has the following comment based on this very point we just saw from Dr. Kellner. It is perfectly evident that Chazal did not present us with a Maimonidean-style creed. Right? On that point, Kellner has made his case. At the same time, it is also evident that they did regard the denial of specific theological propositions as grounds for exclusion from the world to come. When Kellner has completed his discussion of the, quote, one possible exception, that's how he keeps on referring to the Mishnah and Sanhedrin. I'm right, but there's maybe one possible exception. That's how he refers to that Mishnah. He has shown that the Mishnah is not a work of systematic theology. Again, we'll grant Kellner that. But has done nothing to undermine the obvious and unavoidable reality, to wit, that it excludes from the world to come people who deny resurrection and the belief that the Torah is from heaven. Even if we were to endorse the debatable assertion, this is a comment that Kellner does make, that only people who advertise their denial forfeit eternal felicity, which Dr. Berger is not willing to admit that that's all it means, but even if, the fateful action would remain nothing more than a statement of disbelief in a dogmatic proposition. So after you get through all of the stylistic differences, and obviously there's a shorter list, bottom line though, says Dr. Berger, you can huff and you can puff, but you can't blow the essential house down. There is still some kernel of a statement that the rabbis are making in this Mishnah that is outlining what is considered doctrinal, absolutely necessary beliefs in order to be considered a valid believing Jew. And he concludes here in this final paragraph, which is also very important. Now, it may very well be, and this was a comment that we mentioned even last week, we said, even though if it's true, as we already acknowledged last week, that the Rambam did have some innovation, why Dafka did the Rambam in his period do this? What happened that he decided to write these? And we saw two theories, we'll come back to the two theories a little bit later today, but one of the theories, which Kellner subscribes to, is that it was a result of outside pressures. In order to resist the temptations and the polemics against the Jewish people by the Christians, so there needed to be a setting of red lines as to what we believe. It was a polemical response. So Dr. Berger says the following. Now, it may very well be that the rabbis were impelled to single out these doctrines in the wake of the attacks of the Sadducees and other sectarians. In other words, says Kellner, it's not just that the Rambam did it in response to pressure from the outside. Why did the rabbis all of a sudden do it? So we know, in the time of Chazal, there were also sectarian groups known as the Tzedukim, who were challenging traditional Jewish belief. So maybe it's true that that's why the rabbis wrote this Mishnah, as a way of delineating crucial differences between their group and the outside group, the Sadducees. But this position does little to salvage Kellner's overall argument. Right? That is wielding a mighty pen. It means that the rabbis did believe that membership and good standing in the community of Israel rested on certain articles of faith. Since they were indeed not interested in systematic theology, again, a point that Kellner hammers home and home, and Berger is willing to acknowledge, they did not articulate these principles until they were challenged. But once challenged, they fleshed out a position that they had always taken for granted. In other words, a very important point, we'll come back to something very similar as we read the next paragraphs, but the basic debate between these two scholars would be as follows. There's no question there's some level of innovation of the Rambam. The question is how to view the relative silence of Chazal. And even to the extent that they were different than the Rambam, how about the fact that they even have this one Mishnah? So one perspective is essentially Kellner's, which is not that there weren't beliefs, but they didn't really care about them. It wasn't so important at that point in history. Dr. Berger's response is that that's not true at all. In fact, they did. They may not have been interested in systematically making a list of theology, perhaps because it wasn't needed because everyone was more homogeneous. Perhaps because they weren't thinking in those terms. Either way, be that as it may, even if you'll grant that there were specific historical impetus to, whether it was the Mishnah, or even then it was the Rambam, that won't change the fact, again, unless one would want to make this radical point, which Dr. Berger certainly would reject, unless you think that because of these outside responses, they innovated and made up new beliefs. But short of that, what you're essentially, and this is what he says is the inescapable, an undebatable proposition, is that when pressured from the outside, they were forced to more forcefully and consistently and clearly articulate the positions. But that doesn't mean that they didn't always have the same beliefs. It means that without an outside need, they didn't feel to articulate them in a way that the Mishnah and Sanhedrin eventually did, and then hundreds of years later, the way the Rambam did, even further. A final point, which I won't read inside with you per se, but I'll just paraphrase for you, which is the next part of the page, is that Kellner wants to go so far as to say, again, talking about what he calls the laissez-faire attitude of the rabbis, that even on such things as monotheistic belief, or its opposite, God forbid, idolatry, or avodah zarah, he says the rabbis even then didn't really care about the belief inherent in it. Rather, they punish you if you worshipped. It was all behavioristic. It wasn't theological. So Dr. Berger makes, which, again, it's not the most fascinating or razzle-dazzle part of the article, but in terms of if you wanted to rate strength of arguments, it would have to be perhaps Dr. Berger's strongest, and conversely, Kellner's weakest, because he points out that Kellner is simply wrong. That we have sources in Chazal that point to the fact that even thinking about, and perhaps reading about, things that are heretical is in and of itself a violation. Is it the same violation as actually bowing down? Perhaps not. But even thinking about even in one's own thoughts, rejecting a monotheistic belief is considered problematic. So back and forth, again, you have the bibliographical sources if you want to read either of these. Obviously, Dr. Berger's is an article, it's a lot shorter. But the truth is, again, not that I advocate the conclusions of Dr. Kellner, but it's really an eminently readable book, especially with the background you'll have from this series. Okay. Ad Kan, turning back from the Rambam. Again, we were in the Rambam, medieval period, we look back towards Chazal. How radical a departure is he from them? You put together what we just did now with what we did last week, and you have a pretty cool picture of two different views of that question. Now I want to look forward, if you will, or what was the medieval response to the Rambam? Next week we'll get into more modern and contemporary issues. What was the medieval response? What was the response to, if you will, if not exactly contemporaries, but the Rambam's intellectual colleagues, the other Rishonim, to the Rambam? And the truth is that while he had many who probably just accepted him, there were many who argued on the Rambam. Many. And the truth is, as can be often the case for people, and we all know I spent a little bit of time last week, I won't repeat it now, giving you a little bit of a summary of the biography, intellectual and otherwise, of the Rambam. He had plenty of controversy in his life, and this was only a small piece of it. But, as can often be the case here, the Rambam faced two different forms of criticism on both fronts. In other words, some accusing him, if I'll use contemporary terms, some accusing him of being too liberal, and others accusing him, the more popular criticism, of, if you will, being too conservative. What do I mean by that? So let's start, even though anachronistically, this would have been the last one I should have been mentioning from a chronological perspective, but let's discuss the first, because it's really a less popular, but it's an important criticism, and that is the assumption that perhaps, say 13, wow, that's a lot of things, and no wiggle room, I mean, no accidents, without this you're nothing. So there was one school of thought that got on the Rambam because he was being way too soft. He was being, if you will, too generous or too liberal. And perhaps the arch representative of this camp is none other than the Abarbanel. Let me just give you a little bit of a background. He's a familiar name perhaps to you, but just give you a little sense of who the Abarbanel was and a very fascinating perspective on the book that he wrote, which relates to this topic, which really is a fascinating point in its own right. The Abarbanel was born in 1437 and died in 1508. He was one of the most fascinating, colorful, and accomplished people in our history. He was a financier. He was a statesman to at least two different kings that we know about. He wrote an extensive commentary on Tanakh, and he was also, as we will see tonight shortly, a philosopher. There was a time in 1484 where, as I mentioned, the first king, 1471, excuse me, where he was working with King Alfonso of Portugal. And then, very famously, in 1484, he became a very close confidant of King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella of Spain. Of course, if you know a little bit of your Jewish history, you know that 1484 is only 8 years before 1492, which was the Spanish expulsion of the Jewish people. And in his position, and I remember hearing on a tape from a number of years ago, that on Tisha B'Av, Rabbi Weinreb spent a lot of time reading from the Abarbanel's commentary, where he speaks about, autobiographically, his extreme and strenuous efforts to try to get the king to rescind the expulsion. But unfortunately, as we all know, he was ultimately unsuccessful. What I didn't know until researching a little bit of his biography now was that apparently the king had offered him his position. He could stay. But he chose to have his lot, so to speak, with his people, eerily reminiscent of Esther and Purim. And he decided that he's not going to remain isolated, if you will, and protected in the castle. He is expelled as well. He makes his way to and fro, and eventually, not that long later, in 1508, he dies in Venice. One of the books that he wrote, it's a teeny little book, it has 24 chapters, but it's small, it's a very small book, is called Rosh Amana. What is fascinating about this philosophical treatise is that the first 22 chapters of the book are a defense of the Rambam from the critics, which we're about to see shortly, those who felt that the Rambam was being, quote, too conservative. And there's much scholarly discussion as to how to understand this pivot, which we'll not get into tonight, but in the final two chapters, 23 and 24, the Abarbanel apparently, one way or another, you have to say, change his course, at least on some level, because the last two chapters are his criticism of the Rambam. And essentially, if one wanted to boil down, if you will, the criticism of the Abarbanel to the Rambam, it is, as I referred to, that the Rambam was being, if you will, too nice, too soft, too liberal. And why limit it to just these 13? But he has some other interesting things to say. If you turn over your page, I'll briefly go through. I have all of these selections I include with English translations, if it's easier for some. The first thing that the Abarbanel begins here, this is in the chapter 23. Again, you'll note there's no citations from the first 22 chapters, because that's where he's making nice, if you will, to the Rambam. He's defending him. But in 23 and 24, it's where the action is, at least from our perspective, and he is criticizing the Rambam. The first thing he says is he criticizes the entire enterprise, and this will be foreshadowing of his ultimate conclusion. He criticizes not just the Rambam, but all those like him who list any principles of faith. He said this is not, if you will, it's a little bit Kellner-esque. He says this is not a Jewish thing. Why did all of a sudden the Rishonim, starting with the Rambam, list these principles of faith? Well, says it was the problem, is that they were Murav, they were living among the non-Jews, living among the Goyim. And they saw, they were reading non-Jewish books, and they got very into science and philosophy. And they saw that in science, in any system, there are certain axioms, certain postulates that you have to accept in order for the rest of the system to work. You accept certain rules or laws, and then everything flows from there. So they decided that if that's true about these other systems, he accuses them, then that must also be true about Judaism. Of course, the Abarbanel says that's not a good comparison, you shouldn't have done that. But that's what he attributes their motivation. Moreover, if you look in the second source, in the middle of the page here, he says, V'chach me'em unaseinu achrei esher hit'arvu bagoyim, b'iyun sifreim v'yidiyas chachmoseim, lomdu bimaseihem, v'yitiku darcheim v'nyonem b'torah ha'lokis. They were reading their books, they were dispersed, living among the non-Jews. Again, it's worth noting as a historical fact that he says they were reading all these books. But he says they were unduly influenced by all of these books. And they started accepting some of these principles from outside sources and then applying them to Judaism. And then, as I mentioned, as they saw these other systems of thought and philosophy making lists, they said, I'm reading the last part of that second source, they said to themselves, "Esakein gamani b'hanachas ikarim v'yesoros haTorah lokus." They said, well, if this is what other people were doing, the scientists and philosophers were doing, I should do the same thing for my philosophy, that of Judaism. However, says the Abarbanel, the whole thing is a mistake. Because how can you reduce mandated, required, essential Jewish beliefs to any number? Whether it's 13 or a lesser number, as we'll see shortly. It's all wrong. Even 13 is way too little. Because as the Abarbanel says, I'm reading that from the third source, I'll read it on the English. The Torah with all of its beliefs is completely true. All of its commandments were divinely revealed. The validation and substantiation of all beliefs and commandments, minor as well as major, is the same. The validation of one is like the validation of the other. I therefore believe that it is not proper to postulate principles for the divine Torah, nor the foundation of matters of beliefs, for we are obliged to believe everything that is written in the Torah. After all, even he who denies or doubts the belief of a narrative for the Torah, be it small or great, is a sectarian or apikoros. And he repeats this point. That was towards the end of chapter 23, and then in perhaps the climactic quote from chapter 24, the last source on the sheet. Again, I'll read it from the English. I've already counted on the basis of my own opinion that there is no need to lay down principles for the Torah of God which ought to be believed by every Israelite in order to merit life in the world to come. After all, we shouldn't make a list because it's all obligatory. You can't start favoring 13 beliefs over everything else. At the end of last week's class, someone mentioned to me they felt that the Rambam was being too strident, too strict. I said to them, the truth is that there are many beliefs that we have, a lot more than these 13, but the Rambam was saying that these 13 have a special centrality that you could be wrong, but so to speak, survive if you were missing one of the other ones. But for spiritual existence or survival, according to the Rambam, there was no wiggle room. These were each, if you will, it's you can't live without a heart. So according to the Rambam, we have 13 spiritual hearts. Abarbanel is coming from the exact opposite perspective. You can't make one the heart and one the leg and one the finger. You can't live without any of it. Every one of them, every pasuk, every mitzvah, every belief It's all absolutely essential, and it would appear that therefore lack a belief in the lack of any one of them is what the Barbanel sees. Again, if we could, not reading too much into it, perhaps going back to the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, when the Mishnah listed a third thing, which it called an apikores, the Barbanel quotes that idea, perhaps what he understood is that everything else goes into that third category. It's a lot of footnotes for that Mishnah, if you will. So this is, I say, representative of one school of thought, the school of thought which criticizes the Rambam from this perspective. Namely, that he was too lenient, too liberal. 13? How could you stop at 13? It's so much more. But the truth is that this is, relatively speaking, the less popular criticism. There is a more popular criticism, and this, for this you need to turn over your source to the next sheet. The other school of thought, and I have two representatives, perhaps the two most well-known, certainly the most well-known will be the second one we'll mention, two representatives of this other school of thought. The other school of thought thinks that the Rambam is, again, just for the sake of an easy mnemonic for you, too conservative. By which I mean that they thought that the Rambam has 13, that's so strict. Who said that all 13 are absolutely necessary? And this school of thought endeavored to list principles of faith, but felt that it was a shorter list. There's less on the list. If you're on the list, they believed as strong as the Rambam about what it was on their lists. Although, as I mentioned last week, perhaps they didn't agree about the issue of accidental mistakes. But certainly that you have to believe in these things, and intentional, at least, rejection of these would get you off the ship. They believed that. They just felt that which beliefs, how many beliefs are that severe, was a smaller number. As I say, two of the most well-known of this camp, certainly the next one I'll mention is the most well-known, but another well-known one is that of the position by Rav Chasdai Kreskes. Chasdai Kreskes is not so well-known as a Rishon. He lived in the late 14th century in Christian Spain. We don't know so much about his life, but we think he died in 1412 in Saragossa. He tells us of himself that he was a student of the famous Rabbeinu Nissim, the Ran, as well as of Yitzchok Bar Sheshes, the Rivosh. He was very, very active communal leader, and if you're very active in communal leadership, you obviously have less time to be philosophically speculative and pondering and writing books. And the truth is that I think we have extant four books. I'm not sure if the other three are well known, other than perhaps by some Kreskes scholar somewhere, at all in the mainstream. The one book that is at least relatively known is his philosophical treatise, the one that's most relevant for us tonight, and that is called Or Hashem. This he completed right at the end of his life. He tells us he was working on it for years, but I believe he only published it 2 years before he died in the year 1410. He is essentially of the belief that you can whittle down the Rambam's list from 13 to 6. He believes that there are principles of faith without which you can't even move, but that number, those principles, is in fact 6. And I have, again, it's a lengthy book, but just for this, I didn't want to spend too much time on him, I just wanted you to become acquainted with it. So in his introduction, he divides his book up into treatises, what he calls in Hebrew Ma'amarim. His introduction to the second treatise, to Ma'amar Sheni, he tells you what his goal is, his thesis of how this works, and he gives you his list of 6. And I'm just going to read the opening paragraph in Hebrew, and then we'll quickly list the 6 in English. He refers to them, interestingly enough, not so much as ikarim, as if you will, principles, but rather what he calls pinot hatoriot, or cornerstones. A pina is a cornerstone of the Torah. I'm going to read you this introduction, which tells you his purpose. I won't be focusing on it now, but at the end of the lecture, please God, we'll get back to this introduction again. Shehem yisodos va'amudim asher beis elokin nachon aleihem. These are the foundations and the pillars upon which the house of God rests. U'bametziutzam yatzir metzius haTorah. It's only through their existence does the existence of the Torah become possible. U'suderes m'menu yisbarach. U'yu yitzura ha'eder achas mihem. If you're missing any one of these 6, it It's like a cornerstone. A house may have four, if you will, four corners. This has, Torah has six, but the point is in his definition of what makes it onto the list. How come others didn't make it on the list? Because for him to be what we'll call a principle, or he calls a cornerstone, it has to be that without which, logically, the rest of the Torah, which is obviously much greater and much more encompassing, it can't sustain itself. These six need to be there as the foundation, without which the other part of it cannot remain. So what are the six? U'kshechekarnu behem matz'anum shisha. Says Rechaz Dikresis, when I think about it, you got six, and I'm going to read it for you in English. Number one, God's knowledge of existence, meaning he knows what's going on in the world. Number two, his providence over them. Number three, his power. Four, prophecy. Five, choice, meaning free choice. And six, if you will, purpose, or that the Torah leads man to his true goal or ultimate happiness, etc. Now, what's interesting is, again, not so much what he does say, but what he has left off his list. So some of the other things which he left off his list, like a Tchias HaMesim, for example, resurrection of the dead. So given his own definition, we can understand, we can postulate, right? We've been living for a lot of years as a Jewish people, and the Torah has not crumbled because there hasn't been a Tchias HaMesim. And in theory, therefore, if one didn't have that belief, it might be terrible, it might be wrong, but according to him, the whole system doesn't fall apart without it. So that we can kind of, again, just on our own, just think about why maybe he didn't include that. There is one, though, the first one in the Rambam, which he doesn't list, which is perhaps the most surprisingly to be left off the list. And that is that he never lists the belief in the existence of God. And presumably without that, you'd have nothing. So I think the answer to this question as to why he would have left that off is what I have for you in the next paragraph from Rabbi Bleich. This is from that same book. I didn't give you the bibliographic information here. For those who were here last week and have those source sheets, we mentioned that book with perfect faith of Rabbi Bleich. This is from the introduction to that book, page 14. He, again, summarizes the list in his own translation, and he then asks and answers this question, and I think, again, I don't know if others have different answers, but it seems to me that he's right, and I could mention to you what he does not, which is that we have another parallel for this. That is, he says, the reason that Chasdei Kreskes left this off the list is, of course, you wouldn't have anything without this. But the point is, there's something singularly unique about that belief, which is that not only do you not have the rest of the Torah, you don't even have these six. There's nothing to start talking about without the belief in God. So he just took that, not that you don't have to believe it, of course you do, but the point is that that's even more important than this, because you won't come to ask the question of what are the six beliefs that I need to have until you first accept the first. There's nothing to talk about. And I would suggest that it makes sense. Again, it's a speculation, but it makes this, I think it's his own speculation, my blight. I don't know if Chasdei Kreskes says this explicitly himself, but it makes a lot of sense, and I can tell you that there's at least one analogy for this. And that is that in the list of 613 mitzvos, which many of the Rishonim, including the Rambam, was very well known for, the Sefer HaChinuch, and all sorts of other people listed what are the 613 mitzvos. So there are some who leave out, unlike the Rambam, who lists the first one, believe in God. There are others who leave out that belief, like the Bahag. And the most classic explanation to that is, again, the exact same answers by Blunt in this context. Not that, God forbid, the Bahag didn't think he had to believe that, of course. But that he felt there's no point, there's nothing to talk about. 613 what's? Recommendations? Self-help? The whole purpose of having mitzvahs obviously presupposes the first one, which there is a God. The purpose of the 613 is to tell me, what does that God want from me? But you don't need to make one of the 613 that you have to believe in a God. Again, obviously the Rambam disagreed both here and there. He includes the list. But in terms of understanding Chasdei Kreskes, again, that's almost, it was too good of a question. You know, sometimes you have this, probably true in other fields also, but certainly like in Halacha or Gemara study, when you ask a question, if it's so strong, you should at least first take a step back and think about, maybe I'm missing something. Because too strong a question sometimes suggests an ultimate vulnerability. And I think this is an example of that. Because it'd be too strong a question on how he left it out. And therefore, there has to be an answer. I think this is perhaps the most likely answer. The most popular, and it really is to this day, a somewhat popular sefer that's still studied, the most popular representative of this camp of critics, and without a doubt, unapologetic critics, of the Rambam's list of 13 principles of faith, is someone by the name of Rav Yosef Albo. I just have to mention on a personal note There was a former student of Ne'er Israel. He's now at Yeshiva University, but I met him because he moved towards New York and eventually switched schools because he married a girl from Riverdale, a friend of our family when we were living in Riverdale. His name, the Chassan's name, is Rav Yosef Albo. Not Rav. I can't even say the word without saying Rav first. His name is Yosef Albo. I think he wants to be a rabbi. And he is a direct descendant, Ben Achar Ben, of this Rav Yosef Albo from the Middle Ages. Just thought I'd throw that out there. Who was Rav Yosef Albo? The one who we're about to study. So the truth is that we actually know, considering how popular his book is, we know very little about him. He tells us that he was a Talmud of this Rav Chasdai Kreskes, and the Abarbanel, when he mentions him, tells us that he was also a younger student of Rabbeinu Nissim of the Ran. I think he died in about the year 1435. And perhaps the most well-known biographical fact about him is for those who study it all, again, this is back to Dr. Berger's expertise, the disputations, which were very famous in the medieval period. So one of those famous disputations was in Tortosa and overlapped from the year 1413 to 1414, and he was a major player in that. His most significant and enduring literary product is a philosophical work, which extends beyond the critique of the Rambam, but it's really, that's a central component of it, known as the Sefer HaIkarim, which if you understand how he uses the word Ikar and the Mishalom that he uses, it really is probably correctly translated as the Book of Roots, as in the roots of a tree. And that is the image that he uses to determine what he considers are the essential, what he calls an Ikar. He doesn't mean it as a principle. He means it very much as a root, because as we'll see, he has categories and subcategories and sub-subcategories, just like there's the root, and then the trunk, and then the branches, and then the leaves, and he, the continuing and smaller and more successive categories, he takes from that imagery. If you look in the, there is an English translation, I apologize, but I don't have it, it probably is maybe in Baltimore Hebrew, or just it's in an academic, there's a fellow named Husik, I think it was from Philadelphia, it's a five-volume translation of the Sefer HaKarim, but I was not able to get my hands on it for this series, so I apologize, but I will try to translate as clearly as possible from all of these sources. The Sefer HaKarim, if you look at the first of these sources here, this is, again, he also divides this up into what we call treatises or ma'amarim, and most of our sources will come from his opening, which is in Ma'amar Rishon, the first treatise. So the fourth chapter in Parak Dalet, he tells us, again, I'm reading the underlined part, Ki HaKarim HaKolim HaHefachim Ladas Halokit Heim Shlosha. What are, again, the roots or the principles, the absolute core principles that religion absolutely requires? There are three. So we've gone from 13 to 6. And Rav Yosef Albo says, in fact, there are three. The Heim, what are the three? Mitziut Hashem, he does require, including the three, belief in God's existence. V'hashkacha l'schar v'onesh, the fact that God cares about what we're doing down here. There's reward and punishment. And finally, Torah min hashamayim, the fact that this book we call Torah is in fact from heaven. Elu hashlosha heim ha'avos l'cho ha'ikarim asher ladasos ha'alokis. These are the essential roots from which everything else in religion flows. And as he then lets out in the final paragraph, and it's a foreshadowing for what he does the rest of the book, v'tachas kol ikar me'elu, after you have these basic roots, then you have Sharashim, if you, I don't know how you want to translate that, but you have another category, Visi'ifim, Mizrakshim, Mistafim, Min Ikar Hahu. Then you have, so to speak, like a tree, you have branches and blossoms, and everything sprouting out from these. But if you want to know what are the essential three, which everything else flows from, these are the three. What I think is so beautiful, and I have to tell you, I've actually written about a completely unrelated topic that we're doing tonight, on natural law, but I even wrote a graduate school paper on Rav Yosef Albo. This particular paragraph, the second one you have here, I had never studied before, and I was really enchanted by it because it's so beautiful. He points out, again, perhaps it's debatable, but I think, at the very least, I give him an A for effort, but I think it's even more than that. Very beautifully, what he does, and again, there's one thing that he, for sure he has an advantage of, which is, what else have we seen that has the number three? I mentioned at the opening of tonight's class. Very good. We said that even though ultimately there are six things in the Mishnah, it's really the first three in the Mishnah that are belief-oriented or theological. So again, most of the other Rishonim apparently didn't care. Right? 13, right? Even though there's a 3 and 13, and 6 is a multiple, but they don't self-consciously, at least not that I know of, make any association. Rosh Elbow here in this second source I have on your sheet, this is from the 10th chapter of Mamar Rishon, he claims that not only is there a coincidental number, but on the contrary, that his three are just broader frameworks and phraseologies of those three in the Mishnah. Which is really, again, it works out almost poetically. And he tells you, this is exactly what the people and the rabbis in the Mishnah were getting through. For example, end of the first line. V'omru, shakofer b'echad mehem einu b'chlal ba'alei das, ulezein lo chelek olam haba. After all, I'm saying the same consequence. If you deny these three, you're out, as the rabbis were saying there. And it works beautifully, after all. Ha'omer, v'eilu hein she'en lo chelek olam haba, ha'omer ein t'chias ha'mesa min ha'torah. So one of the things that the Mishnah had said, the first thing listed in the Mishnah was, if you deny the resurrection of the dead. Says Rav Yosef Albo, Kolomer, what does that mean? Say, how can I broaden that? Shemakish schar va'onish. The whole underlying principle of the resurrection of the dead is that those who are worthy are rewarded for that. Life after death is all based on a principle of reward and punishment. So he, by mentioning reward and punishment, that's a broader category, but an extension of the first thing mentioned in the Mishnah. Skipping down, he says, V'achar Kain, what's the second thing mentioned in the Mishnah? Ein Torah Min HaShemayim, you deny the divinity of the Torah. Says Rav Yosef Albo, V'hua Ikra Acher, this is the second principle that he had mentioned, or the third principle he mentioned, where he says explicitly, Torah Min HaShemayim. And finally, what's the last thing? V'achar Kain Manu HaApikores. The Mishnah had this general, we mentioned at the time, it's a vague term of Apikores. Olefi Mashinimsel Rishonim Misham Apikores, says the Rav Yosef Albo, what is the meant by this term Apikores? Hu Isha Shechoshiv Sha'olam Nifal B'mikra, Hu Machish Metzius Hashem Shehu HaPoel. He assumes it means somebody who believes that the world is either created accidentally, or it's kadmon, everlasting. It wasn't consciously created by a creator. And that, in fact, of course, corresponds to the third thing that he has mentioned, which is Metzius Hashem, the belief in God. So again, not that this is, you know, if I'm the Rambam, I'm not necessarily, you know, shaking because of this. But it certainly is an added charm to his approach, and that he can, without much effort, adapt his to those three. He doesn't, right? Again, I don't think either of them, the Rambam or Barbanel, I don't think people felt bound by that.
Doesn't the Sefer Ikrim show how all the Rambam's...
We're about... You can turn over the page if you want. Now, an important thing to mention from the Rav Yosef Albo, and this is the last source on this sheet, is that he says something very important. He says, listen, I have to be honest with you, you think you're getting off lucky, right? You'll go home, close the shiur now, but don't mess with a good thing. There's only three, right? Don't have to be so much. So he points out, while it's true that if you deny any of these three, you do lose your portion in the world to come, but acknowledging and believing in these three alone is insufficient. Why? Because this is the underlying part of the last source on your page. Because it's not enough to just believe in these three ikarim, as he calls them, but rather, you also have to know ad shiyode behem ubisharashim hanitlim behem v'hamista afim behem. There's a second category, right? The first prime category is the big three of Rav Yosef Albo, but he has a second category, which we're going to see in a second. And Rav Yosef Albo holds that even though there's obviously a difference, he considers the first three more important. Any of the first two categories, lack of belief in any of the things listed in either of those two categories, gets you in the, the spiritual doghouse. You are in big trouble. So it's not enough just these three, even though, again, he does think there's only 13 essential principles, but in fact, he believes there's others. Rather than, again, it would take way too long and much space to include all of them on your sheet, but I did include the summary, which comes from a very useful and helpful book, which was published in 1985 by a well-known and prolific author of Zecharia Fendel. And one of his books is about the Rambam's 13 principles, called That 13 Principles. And he shows you how, again, he's summarizing it, and I think it's an accurate summary, that that Rav Yosef Albo felt are these three basic roots, but then there's a whole other group of things which emanate from each of these three, and he lists them. So for example, under the Rav Yosef Albo's first one of existence of God, he also adds the details. God's unity and corporeality, that he transcends time and is eternal, and that God is perfect. So there's four other things, all out of that original one. And the second category, the idea of the divine origin of the Torah, Torah Ben HaShemayim. So we have the more general possibility or actuality of prophecy, the specific authenticity of God's messenger, namely Moshe. And finally, in the third thing that Rav Yosef Abel had mentioned, Schar V'Onish, reward and punishment. So Rav Yosef Abel then, in a second category, says what emanates from that is other things, namely the omniscience of God, divine providence, for Schar V'Onish, right? How can he reward and punish us if he didn't know what we were doing? Right? If you have a sub, so the regular teacher comes back the next day, you could be very bad for the substitute, but if the regular teacher doesn't know, he can't punish you. So if God's going to punish us and reward us, he has to have known what was going on. So you see, again, that's an example, again, I just said it quickly, where you see that one obviously presupposes the other, which is where Rav Abel's point is. And finally, that of free will, because if we don't have free will, it makes no sense to punish us or to reward us.
Is there any difference in the hierarchy? Because if he does give it different names...
Yes, I think...
In fact,
yes.
There is
so I think that we'll get to at the end. Thank you. But the in terms of what is important to us, because this is the main theme of our lecture, which is, what are the bare minimum? What do we have to believe in order to be Kol Yisrael Yeshlem Cholek L'Olam Haba, so to speak? So the truth is, it's a little tricky. It's not just the three. The truth is that it's a little bit unclear. This Rabbi Fadel has a footnote here where he points out that even the way he divided these into nine. But the truth is that it's really eight or nine of these, what he calls Sharashim. It all depends, again, it's something that Rav Yosef Abel himself deals with, whether the belief in God, Yediyas Hashem, of Schar V'Onish, reward, and Bechira, of free choice. Do you list all three of those independently, or perhaps only two of those three get listed? That's a kind of academic debate. It would either be eight or nine, but if you add that to the three, you either have 11, or perhaps, if you want to be more specific, 12 principles, which ultimately Rabbi Albo has, after he's criticized the Rambam for having 13. So he says, well, there's only three absolute Ikarim, but P.S., got to read the fine print. In terms of mandated necessary beliefs, he has either 11 or 12. What's interesting is that no matter what, one thing which is not on his list of either of the 11 or 12, which would be, if you will, so you, this is a quick test. The Rambam had 13. Even if you assume 12, what's the 13th? Which one's not there? Part of it, what else? What else? The truth is, I'll tell you the truth. Why not? We're talking about truth. He has a third category as well, in which he then has principles, which he calls anafim, or branches, which he said are absolutely true beliefs that one has to have, but without which doesn't necessarily mean you lose your portion of Olam Haba. And this includes Tchias HaMesim, the coming of Mashiach, the immutability of the Torah, the supremacy of prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu, and the idea of creation ex nihilo of Yesh Me'ayin, that there was nothing and then God created the world. So even if you would add those, which again, they're not absolutes in the same way that the first 10 or 11 are, there's a clear drop-off then when you get to level 3. But what's not even on that is, this is a hard one thing that doesn't even make his top 15, which is one of the Rambam's top 13, is the idea that when one prays, one has to pray directly to God. The fact that there can't be, God forbid, any intermediaries, davening to angels and this kind of thing. Again, it's not because of Yosef Abel didn't agree, but he obviously did not feel that it was nearly as central as the Rambam did. Again, he doesn't even make his, so to speak, top three. Again, it's not, you're going the other direction. Rav Yosef Abel did not feel that whatever's, if the Mishnah was good, if all he was doing was mimicking the Mishnah, so what do you need him for? Right? 100%. So he's doing something differently. His, and this will again, both of your questions are essentially in the same direction, and I'll hopefully answer fully both of them at the end. But the point is, that this has to do with what his goal is, what he defines as a, quote, Ikar. He told us at the beginning, and it's actually very similar in this point, at least his teacher, Kreskes, and that is that things which logically the system depends on. His point, that's his own definition, not the Mishnah's. And that's his starting point. But, I mean, you can almost imagine, you know, like when this light bulb went off for him that one day in his library, this has got to go in the book. You know what I mean? This is how I'm going to sell people on my thing, so to speak. Again, I mean cynically, God forbid. But he was pointing out, and again, I'm sure he felt very happy about this, that there was a certain correspondence of his three, some more limiting, more general, but there was a correspondence of his three to the three in the Mishnah. But he did not feel that Tchias HaMesim, for example, was an Ikar based on what his definition of an Ikar was. But it corresponded to something more broad, that of belief of reward and punishment, which he feels is. But let me move on.
Okay, wouldn't the fact that, that there is no consensus in terms of what, not only the number, but what
okay, yes.
are, argue back towards the first one that you, first criticism you mentioned, which is the Barbanel, like the very fact that we're
Could
trying
be.
To reduce...
Could be.
613...
There are other conclusions that one might read. I wasn't sure how you were, where you were going with the question. But I'll leave that open, because that is, again, what implications there are from some of these debates will be really part of next week's class. One thing, which is, again, you mentioned before as well, and that is that Rav Yosef Abo, at least, again, it's hard to know what others would have thought. He came later. He's in the 15th century. But he, at least, subconsciously goes out of his way to tell us that he doesn't think he's really, really arguing with the Rambam. And there's having an important academic, theoretical debate about classification. But he says, and this is the last source I have inside from Rav Yosef Abo, the Efshar, Kidas HaRambam B'Mispari Karim Hu'al Zeh HaDara SheKasavnu. In other words, we're arguing about a number, a classification system, but he doesn't think that the Rambam would actually argue with anything per se that he says. And on the flip side, he is not actually arguing with any of the actual beliefs that the Rambam enunciated. They're having a debate about the classification, and perhaps in one, and it's really ultimately only one or so, about how severe the lack of belief is in that. But in terms of what's, quote, true, if you want to know, so what do you guys believe? So the truth is that you would get almost identical list of Rav Yosef Abo. Again, this is what he, now, maybe the Rambam would think it's a bigger deal, their debate. But he is almost self-consciously, so to speak, limiting the debate. He points out that he thinks that even for the Rambam's list, if one wanted, you could have said that these three are, so to speak, the roots from which the others germinate from. But that then now begs our final portion of tonight's lecture, and that begs the following question. If Rav Yosef Abo has so demonstrated, and one could argue, again, I didn't go through all of the book with you, that you could really get to all the same conclusions if you understand the system and have just the three, so why does the Rambam, this is similar to the question we ended with last week, which is why does the Rambam, if he is departing from Chazal's tradition, why Dafka now did he write it in his day? Similarly, we could ask, why, it wasn't right, you know, wasn't looking to, you know, it wasn't publish or perish in the Rambam's day. He didn't have to have a longer list. Why did the Rambam feel the need to have a much longer, extensive list if you want to accept Rav Yosef Abo's premise, that really all of Rambam's 13 can be deduced from his three? And this is a question that scholars have struggled with. Yes?
I just wondered, you know, the Rambam had the sheet about clarity, the way he lays out the Mishnah.
Very good, yes.
So maybe the Rambam had a longer list.
So I think the answer is yes, but for one of two possible reasons. And it corresponds to the two reasons we gave last week for why would the Rambam, however radical or not you think it was, but there was some departure, some innovation of the Rambam, why would the Rambam feel the need to innovate on whatever level? We gave two answers last week, and I think those same two answers are two possible answers. And again, you'll have different proponents among the scholars as to which answer is more appropriate. So one answer we gave, which we already alluded to earlier tonight, was as a response to threats from without. Had to draw red lines, much like the theory goes, Chazal were being confronted by the Tzedukim. The Rambam certainly lived in a polemical period. It was very controversial. You know, it wasn't a simple time to be living in Europe, whether it was the Muslims who were there or the Christians. And therefore, in order to define who we were, the Rambam, we said, that's why he innovated, so to speak, and felt the need to enunciate these. Well, this also would go hand in hand answering this question. Namely, right, when you are trying to draw the red lines, you need to be as clear as possible. You don't want to leave anything to a mistake. innocently or otherwise, where one of your own or somebody from without could perhaps get confused about anything. The stakes are too high, right? As they say in speaking, tell them what you're going to tell them, then tell them, and then tell them what you told them. Tell them, tell them, tell them. There's different shitas on how to speak to. That's not totally muskum. But the point is, you got to be clear, and here the stakes are high, you got to be clear. And one theory, Dr. Kellner and others are certainly subscribers to that theory, why the Rambam was so, if you will, if you, from this perspective, verbose. Meaning, why did he have 13 if he could have limited it to 3? But there is another theory, and this is relates to what we mentioned last week as well. We mentioned that Professor Altman, again, we mentioned it was an odd bedfellow, Professor Altman on the one hand, and Rav Elbel Soloveitchik, the Briska Rav, on the other, certainly not a philosopher, far from it, but the two of them had the same theory. And that was that it relates to the Rambam's more controversial theory, which I only touched on a little bit, it's certainly not the topic of our series, the Rambam's theory of what the reward of Olam Haba is. And that is that the Rambam was an extreme intellectual in this regard. And he understood that, the, so to speak, the role of life was, so to speak, to perfect one's mind such that it became what they call the active intellect. And then one leaves their corporeal body and goes wherever they go. So to speak, there's a certain intellectual thing that's going on, which if you don't have the mind for, you can't appreciate. It's not a reward for you. We mentioned the analogy that Rabbi Bleich gave last week of someone, and I thought it could easily be me, I hope the analogy doesn't go all the way, but at least in the literal crude analogy that Rabbi Bleich says he's giving, of someone who can barely get through, you know, high school algebra or something, so you wouldn't be doing him a favor by enrolling him in advanced calculus, or it would be torture. It doesn't make you a bad person, it's not your fault. But that is what it is. That's how Rabbi Bleich explained Rambam's position that even accidental heresy is still heresy. Because he says, we're not blaming you, but if you don't have the right beliefs, you haven't perfected your mind in the right way, it's an ebuch, but you still don't have it. So to here, perhaps, and this is the theory that the Rabbi Bleich here, this is, if you will, the one I have from Rabbi Bleich on page 17, he attributes this also to the Briska Rav. He says this is the same point. Why did we say last week, why did the Rambam feel the need to have a whole list to begin with? Because listen, how many of us are really brilliant enough to be this kind of speculative philosopher that the Rambam enjoyed? How much people have the time, right? We got to make a living, we got to feed our family, we got to do things. So what the Rambam felt, again, this is as the theory goes, Professor Altman, again, is certainly a huge scholar in his own right, says this, and the Briska Rav, says that's why he made this list. So this would be like the Cliff Notes. As long as you at least knew these 13, and again, they're certainly, again, not that you'll understand them the same way some genius philosopher understands them. But if you at least have a basic understanding of these 13, that will, so to speak, perfect you enough intellectually to appreciate the world to come. So says the Briska Rav, you're right. If I was writing a list for my advanced students, for those who are going to be a philosopher, who could ultimately be the super-duper intellect, so then if they have these 3, they could make all the deductions that Rabbi Albo did. You can see how the 3 got to the same 13, wonderful. But the whole point of the list is not for that super philosopher. The whole point of the list is for, I'll at least include myself and perhaps some of you assembled, who are not going to be great philosophers. And therefore, perhaps don't have the time or maybe not even the intellectual acumen and ability that you could have made these deductions from these 3 to 13. So the fact that, again, if we were looking for, if the goal was an economy of words or space, you know, and again, philosophically it's tighter to limit it to these core 3 and let everything else flow from there. Beautiful! The Sefer Eikarim is a beautiful Sefer. It was very popular in its day. Perhaps the most popular book of philosophy in the Middle Ages. And it's still, to this day, somewhat popular. It's a beautiful, beautiful work because he did it all for us. But it doesn't mean that every one of us, if we had just been given his 3, could have figured out how to classify them, so to speak, the way that Rabbi Fendel had summarized the Sefer Eikarim's way. And therefore, it would have been counterproductive to have the limited list of 3. Again, this is all, I just paraphrase what Rabbi Bleich says there in that paragraph of 17. It's interesting, I don't know any other source for it other than that it's an oral tradition that, so to speak, this Rabbi Fendel quotes. He says something else in the name of all people, Rav Elbel Soloveitchik's father. Chaim Brisker, again, he has a footnote where he says he saw it in some other book, but it's certainly not in any family tradition or written from Chaim himself. This is another theory for why the Rambam had 13 instead of 3, and that is almost, I don't know how to describe it other than he just felt that the Rav Yosef Apple has all these categories and subcategories and subcategories. The Rambam felt these 13 are equal. To say, you asked me before, is what's the difference? After all, if you have to believe in all of them anyway. So for some reason, the Rav Yosef Apple felt that there was some hierarchy. This possibility that Rabbi Fendel quotes is perhaps saying that that was that little nuance is what the Rambam rejected. I'm not sure, but
there would be a disagreement between Rabbi Yosef Alba and the Rambam. A small disagreement.
About, even according to this. Listen, the bottom line, they have two different lists. So there's something going on. What the debate is, again, relates to some of the different theories we mentioned.
Last thing from Chaim, it could be kind of a dispute about semantics, you know.
Classification.
How many
moves
to carry in your shirt pocket.
Classification.
According to the last thing, it's more than that. It's really,
unless,
like, God forbid, you have a choice. You can only choose three.
Right, I understand.
Yosef Alba will tell you which three to pick. Rabbi
right.
Say,
all 13 or nothing, right. Yeah. You're right. The only thing I will just say is, even on that last point, the fact that the Rambam says you need all 13 and that we're suggesting what the reason is for, because of this whole theory of Olam Haba and stuff, it could be that by Rav Yosef Alba saying there's only his three, that might reflect the fact that he argues on that whole scheme of the Rambam. But again, that's beyond what we're studying tonight, though. The last thing I want to mention to you, and now if we turn the page, is that what has already been hinted at, and a few perceptive listeners have already raised the point, is that what seems to be going on here is not so much a debate about what's true and not true, and not even about, for the most part, the consequences of wrong belief, but rather what seems to be going on is an interesting but more theoretical academic debate. What's the purpose of having a list at all? If you look at the top of the sheet, it's Rav Yosef Albo himself, and it really corresponds, I believe, to what his teacher, even though they disagreed on the number, but his teacher of Chasdei Kreskes has said, and we read it together, and that is that they had a different theory completely. Their theory was that anything that goes on the list is something that without which the whole system, there can't be a system of Jewish law, a Torah, without these beliefs. So Rav Yosef Chasdei Kreskes thought 6, Rav Yosef Albo thinks 3, but I think, at least for the most part, that they agree in the purpose. At least one can make that argument, although we'll see in a second, perhaps not everyone agrees with that. But that's a different perspective than what we began with from the Rambam. And I want to share with you two different, summaries of what these different positions might be. One coming from, again, the two most scholars that we've quoted most frequently over these last 2 weeks, Rabbi Bleich on the one hand, and Dr. Kellman on the other. So if you look at Rabbi Bleich, that's in the middle of the sheet, he suggests three theories, and he differentiates, unlike what I just said before, Rabbi Bleich differentiates between the teacher and the student, he differentiates between Kreskes and Albo. So the first thing that he says is, they are disagreeing with regard to what they are endeavoring to formulate. Albo is intent upon formulating a system of axioms consisting of the sine qua non of any system of religious belief. Kreskes, on the other hand, is not concerned with the premises of religious belief, but with the unique claims of faith set forth by Judaism. So that's a very nuanced debate that, according to Rav Yosef Albo, all religions in theory would have to depend on these three, so that's why it's a smaller list. Whereas if the Chasdei Kreskes is more specific, what does Judaism need to stand on its own feet? Says the Chasdei Kreskes, 6 things. But on that common principle of what does the religion in question need to be able to sustain itself, they agree that that's the purpose of the whole thing, and that on that entire theory and thesis, the Rambam is arguing. Finally, Maimonides, depending upon which explanation is accepted, either presents a particular belief which require bolstering and reinforcement. Again, that's the polemical, historical context, threats from without, therefore the need to respond, or the minimum content of theological knowledge necessary for the development of the, quote, acquired or active intellect, which in turn makes possible the reality of immortality. So whichever of the two theories we've been going back and forth with the Rambam is very different than the other school of thought. Finally, Kellner has a different grouping, and that is he puts the teacher and student together, as we've mentioned, Rav Yosef and Chasdei Kreskes on the other hand. The Rambam, everyone agrees with what he was trying to accomplish, and the third is he gets back to the long-forgotten Abarbanel. And he says, again, the Abarbanel says that you got to believe in all 613, every pasuk in the Torah. What are you talking about? You can't start differentiating. I, the Abarbanel, did defend the Rambam the first 22 chapters of his book. So he says that this is Kellner's theory, is that the purpose of the Abarbanel, in his opinion, what is the purpose of having, quote, principles of belief? It's just pedagogic and like a mnemonic. It helps you remember these things. But it's not to differentiate on any level in Abarbanel's theory between those 13 or 6 or 3, whatever you'd want, and anything else. Because in terms of actual level of importance, we saw inside that Abarbanel holds that you can't make any differentiation, that one would lose Olam Haba on a Dover Katan or a Dover Gadol, big or small, it all is the same. Be that as it may, I think it is clear that there's different goals going on, and as we know in many areas of life, form follows function. If you have a different goal in mind, it might lead you to a different belief. What we have basically seen, though, and with this I want to conclude and set the stage for next week, with very little, and there's a little bit more I could have mentioned, but for the most part, certainly for the most part, everything we've seen now has absolutely agreed on the substance of all of these particular beliefs. The only debate seems to be somewhat theoretical, perhaps the issues of severity a little bit, but we have to know still what are the real consequences of even this debate. Moreover, what I'd like to do a little bit next week is discuss some different, whether it's Rishonim or Achronim, people who actually debated the substance of some of these particular principles or beliefs of the Rambam. And then finally, turn our attention to the most delicate and sensitive, and I hope not, but perhaps controversial part of the series, and that is what are the real practical contemporary consequences of differentiating belief. Because obviously, to borrow something that's probably more often a phrase from people of other religions, there's none of us here who's not a sinner. So if we just focus on issue of mitzvah observance, even though we sometimes draw lines that way also, but the truth is those are not nearly as bright red. If you think about it, and I'll leave it vague intentionally, but if you think about it, much of our self-definition is more about different theological premises and beliefs. And certainly, this entire discussion, which again, I believe is Torah Lishma anyway, but this medieval discussion that we're getting into, very much can, I think should, inform some very contemporary and modern questions, and at least as a system, a prism through which to look at some of them. We certainly won't be solving all of the world's problems next week. I mean, you thought it was really popular next week. We'll solve all the problems. So I had to disappoint you. We won't. But at least to understand some of the different schisms within the Jewish world today, which I really believe connect to what we've been studying, please God, that will be next week's lecture. Thank you very much for coming. I'll stay for a few minutes to answer questions, although I want to let people have some dessert. But I have to apologize ahead of time. I have another simcha that I have to get to, so I'm only going to be able to stay for a few minutes. Thank you very much for coming.
Drinks in the kitchen, not in the dining room, please. Help yourself.